Yes, all right.
I have a question here, and I want to ask a question. Do you think God's a capitalist or a socialist? Okay. God's a capitalist.
Yes, sir.
I do too. And I want to go in to this. When Richard Nixon first began to run for Congress and then the Senate in California, the man who had the Senate seat was a pretty left-wing socialist. And he was a very religious man. You know, now folks, let me explain something here. I talked to the Montgomerys a while ago and said, if they're ready to start making Ray Ray sit in that seat, we'll endure it, okay? We're a church, okay? When she goes to school, she has, but if they're not ready, we'll endure her still being loose. That's their choice. If you've noticed, they're having her sit there, and there's times she's a little bullish about it, all right? Doesn't quite like it, but you know what? That's family. That's us, okay? That's who we are. All right, but Richard Nixon's opponent was one of these Quaker-type men. Went to kind of a liberal church, and he was a socialist. And back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, most of the politicians who were socialists were not atheists. They were religious. That was just considered the right thing to do. John Mark and I have been listening on audiobooks to a series of books about a Jewish rabbi in Massachusetts, and pretty good mystery stories, but what's fascinating about the books is it goes into the Jewish mind. Boy, I'll tell you what, you listen to this and you really begin to understand how Jews think. And at one point, I think it's around the third book, the first book starts in 1964, we're up to about 1970, there's mini skirts and hippies and people smoking pot. And there's a big move in the synagogue to become more socially aware, to step in. There's a major book out called Why Are Jews Liberals? And a very conservative Jew that I read behind said, you know, when I read it, he said, I was really proud of being a Jew. Their motives were really good on why they became liberals. But most of the Jews I know who are conservatives say right now the Jews are blind. They do not understand what's coming down the pike at them, how anti-Semitic the left really is and such. But at the same time, it comes from a misapplication of Scripture. Misunderstanding what the Scriptures are saying. And we're going to take a look at that very issue here. If you would, turn with me to Exodus chapter 22. You know, Zane, one of the hardest things I had when I went in the Air Force, they made me wear shoes. It really was hard. Man, I had calluses on my feet. They were as good as platform shoes. But you talk about the misery of then wearing boots, you know, 12, 18 hours a day with those socks and everything, and slowly those calluses are beginning to rot, you know, because you're not using them. And it was rough. That guy, some of you met Kenny Stallings, the guy who was my superior in the military, and he's just died because I'd come to the plant barefoot. I'd have my uniform on, I'd be barefoot. I got called to the captain's office one time, Airman Asquith, you know, and I tried to tell him, you know, it's killing my feet putting these shoes on. Slowly they won. All right. Yeah. You know, the funny thing was, when I first got to Greece, and this is an odd story, but I got there and we were up on this mountaintop, and it took an hour and a half to get from the gathering point. The Hotel Castree is where everybody would gather, and they put trucks there, and these six-pack pickup trucks, and we'd drive up there and get up to the top of the mountain. So whenever you wanted to go up there, you waited at the Hotel Castree. So it's my first night there. My hair is not in regulation. I've got civilian clothes. I go into the bar, and I'm not proud of that, but I went into the bar, and there's a guy sitting at the bar next to me, and he's in a miserable mood. And the two of us talked. And at that time, again, the Kemp-Roth bill was the big thing, which later became Reagan. We discussed that. And he's talking about his investments in the Air Force. What do you do for a living? He said, well, I'm a captain in the Air Force. Okay. And he then says, he said, but just luckily, I've got a line number for Major. I grabbed his arm, I spun him around, shoved him against the wall, said, nobody makes Major by luck in the United States Air Force. He goes, thank you, sir. You know, we're more than our cops, you know. So the next day, I had to go report to my commander, and it's him. And we just looked at each other, and I never said a word. He never said a word. But from that point on, I was golden. Since Joseph dragged me in before him, you know, I'm so angry and I've done this and that, he, you know, poo-poo it or whatever, like, airman asked me, you have to wear shoes. All right, Exodus 22, verse 5. Okay, you know what? Let's do this. It's not the verse I wanted, so naturally. Let's go to Leviticus 25. I got two down here. I put a backup there in case my wife screwed it up again. Yeah. You travel a lot, babe. It's hard. All right, Exodus, Leviticus 25, look at verse 35. Leviticus 25, verse 35. And if thy brother be waxen poor and fall into decay with thee, then thou shalt relieve him, though he be a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with thee. Take thou no usury for him or increase, but fear thy God, that thy brother may live with thee. Now what's usury? Usury is interest, okay? So let's say that, you know, we're all here and, you know, let's say that one of the families here just fell into some pretty hard times. And we feel bad for him. And, you know, the rest of us are going to McDonald's three times a week. He can only go twice a week. You know, it's just an awful situation. But no, in all seriousness, I'm to take care of it. Do what I can. But what God forbids, I charge interest. Well, Kyle, I know you guys have trouble paying your electric bill. Here's $100 to pay it, and next week you'll be back 110, okay? And that was absolutely forbidden under the law of God. You could not do that. Now, is that generally then that usury was bad? Now, in the Middle Ages, usury was against the law. And yet it happened all over the place. It happened that Jews would do the usury. And they themselves would lend money, and then it gave them a terrible name, but the kings would give them an exemption, okay? And give the Jews an exemption to do it, and of course, they're good at it. And, you know, the Jews have a joke. Why do Jews have big noses? Because the air is free, you know? But that's, they always used to say, too, how can you tell a Jewish neighborhood? Because the toilet paper's hanging on the line to dry, you know? But they're good. They save money. They do well. God's blessed them with that. He's given them that ability. And so the kings would allow them to do that. Then people hated the Jews because they're charging as usury. They're doing this against law. Let me tell you something. It said you don't charge usury to your brother. But when you put money in the bank, you're charging them usury. They're giving you back. It's not much anymore.
No.
Okay? That's one of the things George Gilder, who's a conservative economist who also preaches, he's fascinating because he is the man that designed China's monetary policy. He's a conservative. And he sits back and mocks the West because they cannot touch their monetary policy. And what he did is he stabilized it. What do you mean by that? He said, well, how would you like to be a carpenter and you have to call in every morning to find out how much a foot is? Well, it's 11.8 inches today. Then you call in the next day, well, it's 12.1 inches today. And he said, American and European economists have to do all their thinking and their banking that way every day. What he did is he taught the Chinese to peg the yuan to the dollar. Peg it. The dollar moves up, the yuan does. They're always equal. Always up and down. That,
If it's 3-1, it never changes whatsoever. It floats with that. And it never changes. And he said, as a result, the Chinese don't have the agony the Americans do. Now, let me give you an example of that. When you, if you went to buy a German-made product, and then suddenly the euro changes in value and the American dollar changes, do you realize your product doesn't change value in Walmart? The reason is because banks filter that money. All money transactions between Asia, Europe, and the United States filter through those banks, and they take a percentage of it to the point of $1 billion per second. Per second. And George Gilder said that's basically what rotted Main Street America. That little extra they began taking to do that. But there is no filter between China and the United States. It's always the same. George Gilder did that. He's a Christian. And he designed China's monetary policy. But one of the things he talks about is he said, under the last administration, he said they managed to steal time from the American people. He said, what do you mean steal time? Well, how many of you remember when your parents bought a house and so a year, and then after 30 years, it had all this value to it? They bought bonds, government bonds, and you know, they weren't smart in investing, but you know, after 10, 15 years, it was worth all this extra money. The last administration took that away. Mm-hmm. You can buy bonds now, they're worth far less. You know, you're better off putting your money in a cellar than buying bonds. And they stole time from the American people. It's just something the bankers took over. They stole that from the American people. Time now belongs to them. Doesn't belong to mom and dad. Doesn't belong to the person buying a house anymore. Doesn't belong to the person buying bonds. It got taken away from them. And, you know, it's just, and again, it's fascinating. It's called The Scandal of Money, George Gilder. If you're fascinated with that kind of thing, read it. You'll understand what he's talking about. But regardless of that, God designed usury, that ability for you to put money in the bank and it goes more. Now let me show you something. Go with me to, before we go there, go to Deuteronomy 23, look at verse 20. Deuteronomy 23, look at verse 20. Hopefully my wife got this one right. Yeah, look at that, she got it. All right. Deuteronomy 23, verse 20. Unto a stranger thou mayest lend upon usury, but not unto thy brother. Okay? But unto thy brother thou shalt not lend upon usury, that the Lord thy God may bless thee in all that thou settest thine hand to, and the land whither thou goest to possess it. Okay? So God specifically said, yeah. Out there in the commerce, the straight good guy, go ahead, lend him money on usury. Get some interest out of it. It's a wise thing to do, okay? Just don't do it to your brother. If you got a relative or something, you don't charge him interest. If you got somebody that's a brother in Christ, you don't charge him interest. You lend him money, okay? Now go with me to Matthew chapter 25. Matthew chapter 25, verse 27. If you remember what the context of this is, Jesus Christ talked about the man that went on a king, and he went on a long trip, and he gave everybody a talent to work with. And then he comes back to get his own. And a couple of people had gone out there and worked with it, and had him extra, and one guy was afraid, so he hid it. He buried it in the backyard. And here's what he told him. Verse 25, and I was afraid and went and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, there hast thou that is thine. In other words, he gave him back 100%. All right? Lord gave him something, he gave back 100%. His Lord answered and said to him, thou wicked and slothful servant, thou knewest that I reap where I sowed not and gathered where I have not strawed. Thou oughtest therefore to have put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I might have received mine own with usury.
So if usury was bad, do you think Jesus would use it in a parable? They talk about, you know, whorehouses in a parable. No, we don't talk about that. Yeah, they're bad. They're evil. Okay? They talk about drunkenness. No, it's evil. He's not going to go ahead and tell this guy you should have done that if usury is a bad thing to do. So right off the bat, you need to understand that God himself, the father of all mathematics, the one who makes all things work, okay, he himself has condoned interest. That's not an evil thing. You know, one of the other books George Gilder wrote, he wrote a book called Wealth and Poverty. And it's such an instructive book. He talks about a medieval king who had a cellar full of gold and jewels, but ate haunches of bear meat, wrapped, you know, bear skins around him to stay warm, drafty old castle. And he said, you people reading this, got central heating in your house. You know, you don't have that kind of wealth in your basement, but really you're wealthier than that king. And you talk about what really is wealth. What is it? And wealth is a number of things. A, it's the skills you have is part of your wealth. Castro learned that when he kicked the small business owners out of Cuba. He went through Cuba and everybody had a small business. He just took it away from them. And he allowed them to go to Havana with the shirt on their back, nothing else, and fly to Miami. So about 1960, all the small business owners of Cuba flew to Miami. And he said, ha ha, now we have it all. Well, Cuba hasn't done real well without them. Small business owners are the number one employers in the United States. It's not GM. They are the number one. More people work for a small business in the United States combined than all the other industries. Okay, they are the number one thing. So what a foolish man to get rid of those people. The next thing is, what do those people do? Well, National Geographic did a study on them because, remember the things, the last Americans leave Miami, please bring the flag. Because they turned Miami into a Spanish-Cuban town. They owned Miami. They came there and took it over. How did they do that? Well, National Geographic actually did a thing on them and found that what would generally happen, a man would sit there, he might have two daughters, three sons, and you know, the oldest son is 16, and what he would do is leave the women in Miami, and he and the boys would go somewhere in a bus, Chicago, New York, Buffalo, something like that, and they would all work two or three jobs, and they would live on dog food. They'd live on old stale bread. They'd live on anything they could. The women would take in ironing. They did clean toilets. They'd do anything they could. And at the end of 1 year, the family would come back together and buy a business. And that was the end of their poverty. And they bought Miami. Okay? I used to have a guy come in here, I need a job. No, I'm not going to McDonald's working for minimum wage. Then you don't really need a job. Okay? You know what you do when you need a job? You take whatever you can and you go get that job. Whatever you can. You go get that thing. You go work. And the thing is, you have to learn to live on less than 100% of your money. And that's the key. And if you can't, if you start making $100,000, you still wouldn't live on a percentage of your money. You'll either learn to do it on nothing or you won't. Ruth Ann and I one time invited a missionary couple that we saw in great distress. They had been in Malawi for many years, and Malawi is a pretty poor country in Africa. And they'd been there for many years, and they'd contracted a cancer and had to come back. Malawi was going through a lot of revolution and such at the time. And they were living in a little RV, and we noticed they just had nothing. And we told them, well, you can come park our RV on our land, you know, where we lived in South Carolina. And they did, and they, you know, and we'd watch them, do things and such. Well, when they finally got to go back to Malawi, they left us their will and everything, and we were the sole, they owned buildings in Baltimore, and they owned all this real estate and stuff. They just, between themselves, they always lived on their income. Since they were making almost nothing a week, they lived on almost nothing. But even on that nothing, they still invested some. Always did that. And so here we're taking care of like the poor people or whatever. They got wealth. But again, it's that idea again that they knew they had learned that thing, how to be content with where they were. It was fascinating because when they got to Malawi, they wondered why the missionaries were having such a hard time there. And one of the things they noticed was that in Malawi, people walked together like we'd take buses together. The women would actually gather. They're going to go to the next village, and it's 5 miles down. And the women would all gather about 9 o'clock in the morning. And finally, when there's 10, 15, 20 of them, all the children, then they walk together. So they said, we're not going to get a car. We're just going to walk in those groups. And they did. And they just infiltrated those groups and got to know them and worked with them and everything. And then when the old leader died in his 90s, who'd been educated in Scotland, and he was the old revered leader, the communists took over. And the first thing they did is they kicked out all the foreigners. They wanted them all out. And the foreigners could go to the capital, and they could get a special exemption to stay there, and people were there begging for them and that. And they're standing there in line, and they got African clothes on and everything, and the most one of the most radical leaders there walked up, grabbed them by the arm, pulled them out, scolded the people. These people are Africans. Why are you kicking them out? And it was one of the most radical people there, but he knew that they just walked with the Africans, they lived with the Africans. And so he pulled these white people out, scolded those bureaucrats. Why are you kicking them out? Okay. So, did they have wealth? Yes, they did. A, their wealth was their ability to live wherever they were. That's a great wealth. Then their wealth was their ability to always save no matter what they're making. Then their wealth was their accumulated savings in the things they had. We have people in this church. Let's say that people went to the Balos right now, and let's say awful thing happened and everything was taken away from them. Bob can still drive. Okay? He can still go out there. His wife can still make one piece of rice, feed 3 people, all right? So you can still do that, all right? Audie can still go take care of animals and that. Dustin can still grow, all right? But they can all do that. Why? Because part of their wealth is that ability that's in them. That's what they have, okay? And people need to understand that that's where wealth begins, your ability, what you can do. I've often said this thing, for some of you who live in poverty and always impoverished and such, and there are valid reasons for that. God forbid that I say there's not, okay? I got a single mother sitting here, you know, who's all sorts of problems and traumas that are happening in her life and disabilities and everything else. And, you know, I'm not going to judge her by the same standard that I judge Timothy, all right? It's not going to work that way. But at the same time, keep in mind that the documents you have in your wallet, what do you mean? My driver's license. Maybe your birth certificate, you have in a file somewhere, your social security card. I could go over to Asia or Africa and I can find somebody that's had a lot worse life than you, put those documents in their hand, and they'll come here and they'll make something in this country. Okay? If they could just sit where you do now, if they could just do that, they'd make something in this country. They would end up with wealth. George Gilder talks about a Laotian family in Massachusetts that were moved into Massachusetts. And it's one of these old towns that's dying, you know, kind of like these towns around here where factories are moving out and nothing's working well or anything else. And they put them all on food stamps and welfare and everything else. And the old man was bored, so he got on his bike and rode down the road and he saw a farm. He had a little money, so he bought a little produce, and he went back into town and sold the produce by the side of the road, doubled his money. So the next day, he went out with a bigger basket, double farms, came back. Then he sent his kids out all onto different farms. And he said 5 years later, the man had bought buildings in the town, turned them into fresh markets. People from Boston were moving out there. The man was wealthy again, like he had been in Laos, okay? And why? Because he knew how to do it. The wealth wasn't what he had in his pocket. The wealth was his ability. The wealth was his knowledge. The wealth is what he knew what to do. Okay? And so the thing is, if you keep that in mind, the wealth isn't what you have in the bank. The wealth is the ability you have, that your skills you have, your ability to go out there to do something. That's what your true wealth is. All right, let's do this. I want you to go to the book of Acts, Acts chapter 5. But how many people, if you'd lived in that town in Massachusetts and you'd watched it slowly shrink, like we're watching Allegheny County shrink, And you saw this welfare family come in from Asia, would have thought, he's going to save our town. He's going to make our town wealthy. God knew it. Acts chapter 5, I want you to look at this and start in verse 1. Here's a common place for Christians who think that socialism is right. But a certain man named Ananias, with Sapphira his wife, sold a possession and kept back part of the price, his wife also being privy to it, and brought a certain part and laid it at the apostles' feet. Now, why are they doing this? Keep this in mind, that we learned in Acts chapter 3 and 4 that they all pooled their possessions together, men sold their lands and everything else and lived together. A couple things we need to understand. They are expecting the imminent return of the Lord, and that's not a foolish thing. God tried to come back. Jesus Christ tried to come back in Acts chapter 7. And if you study Leviticus 4 and understand the sin offering, you'll see why. They then stoned Stephen, and God shuts Israel as a nation off. Not all the Jews. Israel is a nation, a corporate unit. Okay? Shuts them off. They're waiting for the imminent return of Jesus Christ. The second thing is, when a Jew sold his land, how long was it gone? Yeah. You Jew believe it all comes back to him. Okay? So the idea that a person would sell their land, put it into the house of God, it ain't going to leave the family. It's going to come back again, all right? So they're living in a different situation than us. But here we have a man now that sold his possessions, and he keeps part of it for himself and gives the rest to the Lord. Now, verse 3, but Peter said unto Ananias, why hath Satan filled thine heart to lie to the Holy Ghost and keep back part of the price of the land? When Ruth Ann and I were in Lindenville, Vermont, the next town up was called Island Pond, Vermont. And in somewhere about 1984, maybe even early 85, the Island Pond, Vermont made a huge splash in the news. I remember NPR carrying it because social services went to Island Pond, Vermont and took 110 children out of houses and took them away to put them in foster care. Because they had a cult living up in Island Pond, Vermont, of people who were sharing all, they sold all their goods, and they put them all in one basket together. And I actually went and met the people. They were an offshoot of the Dave Wilkerson thing. Those who remember him, you know, the sword and the switchblade and such. They were an offshoot of that. But they made up their mind that God wanted, they used to use this to people and say, hey, you know, God will kill you if you keep that part of your stuff. And that's obviously a pretty cultish thing. What happened, though, and this is typical, this is why we need judges, social services showed up with a judge with 110 children. He looked at the whole thing and banged his gavel and said, you'll take every one of them back. You have no recourse under law for this. You're going to have to show me a lot more to take these children away. All right? And it made national news, and they had shamefaced back, go back to every family and take them their children back. Because in reality, the children were not being harmed. They really were. I mean, they're harmed in the sense their parents are screwy, but a lot of our children have that problem, right? All right? So the thing is, they made them take them all back. Well, let's look at this thing. Is this why Ananias and Sapphira died? Because they kept back part of it. Here's what Peter says. Verse 4. Well, it remained. Was it not thine own? Yes, it was. That's the answer. Yes, it was theirs. And was it, when it was sold, was it not in thy power? Why hast thou conceived this thing in thine heart? Thou hast not lied unto men, but unto God. So what is Ananias' sin? Ananias' sin isn't that he kept back part of the money. Peter said it was yours to do that with, okay? That was yours to do it with. The sin was in lying to everybody and to God and saying that you gave it all. In other words, if you came and told this church, hey, you know, my parents died and I'm leaving half of the money, you know, to you folks or whatever, God sees that as though you lying to the Holy Ghost if you don't give half of it. You don't have to give half your money. You don't have to give 10% of your money. You don't have to give a penny to this church. We've never made that a rule here. People ask me about a guide for giving, okay? Well, let me ask you a question. When Jesus Christ sat in the temple and he watched people put money in the treasury, who gave the most money? The woman with the two mites. How about the people who put $100 bills in there? No, the woman with two mics. Why? Because God doesn't look at the amount.
Yeah.
He looks at the percentage. Okay? He looks at percentage. Doesn't look at amounts. You know, you go ahead, you get a minimum wage job, you're working 25 hours a week at McDonald's, barely making it, saying to yourself, hey, we'll put $15 in the offering every week. That might be a huge sacrifice for you. You might be out giving a lot of people. But then you go ahead and get some job somewhere with the government, and you're making $60,000 a year, still putting $15 a week in there. God doesn't see that as a big thing anymore, okay? But if you haven't made a vow, you haven't sinned against anybody, okay? So when you make a vow and tell God, this is what I'm going to do, that's where the problem begins to come in. So people ask me, how much should I give? Well, first of all, that's between you and God. Okay? That's not a thing here. Never has that been an issue in this church where you had to give a certain amount of money. It's never been that. Okay? But the Apostle Paul said, as the Lord hath prospered you. As. That's percentage. Percentage. Well, what percentage should I get? Well, I can make one. 2.869%. No, why don't I go with the one that all the people in the Bible used? Wouldn't that be wise? That's what I do. There's no law that puts me under a tithe. There's no law that puts that. I have people who come here who believe that I am covetous and that I'm putting people under a burden because I do that, okay? Randy got chewed out over that. The idea that he tithes. Where does God tell you to tithe? He just told you to give percentage-wise. That's the principle. What percentage do you want to pick? 9.2%. Why not use the one God? Why don't you use one Abraham used when he wasn't under the law? Why not use the one Isaac and Jacob used when they weren't under the law? Why not use that one? Okay? Why not try it out? Why not see if it works? And again, I'm like, you know, and I've always loved this thing. I just remember sitting with Dick Botens and Paul Gordon. And I'd had a person come to me and say, you know, in our family, we're just not allowed to tithe, and I feel terrible. And I told that person, I said, don't you worry, that's never been an issue here, okay? And so I told my two deacons that. And both of them looked at it, boy, Pastor, you were so wise to say that. And both of them said, we had to learn to tithe. It was a long time, we just couldn't bring ourselves to do it. And then we learned, oh my goodness, when we learned to tithe, we learned how much better our money managed, how much better it lasted, how much better we got along with it. And they both commended me for how I gave that answer. You know that? And I was happy with it. Just the wisdom of a couple old men that lived for a long time in the house of God. But it goes back to this thing again. Just don't lie to God. Okay? Don't lie to the people. Do what you say you're going to do. The issue why these people died, Ananias and Sapphira, isn't because they kept back part of the money. It's because they conspired to look more religious than they really were. Peter Ruckman said he'd be a lot of deaf in America if he buys that ear. People trying to look more religious than what they really are. All right, go with me if you would to Matthew chapter 20. And we're going to go to verse 8, another famous parable where the people labored all day long and everybody got paid the same. Matthew chapter 20, look at verse 8. So when even was come, the Lord of the vineyard saith unto his steward, call the laborers and give them their hire, beginning from the last unto the first. And when they came that were hired about the 11th hour, they received every man a penny. So in other words, this guy's got a crop to bring in. And he thinks to himself, well, you might get by with 10 guys on this. So they hire 10 guys and say, by the way, we're going to give every one of you a penny that works today. Okay? And they all agree. And then he looks and realizes, you know, it's not getting done very well. We really got more. Then he goes down that way. Well, there's still guys around. So he says to the other guys, hey, you go work in the field. Now there's only 5 hours left. They go to work. Then pretty soon he sees some guys, only an hour left, but hey, go help with the cleanup. Go on, go help with it. So they go. So he pulls the last ones in, he gives them a penny. What he'd agreed to give the first ones for all day work. He gave them a penny, okay? And it says this. Verse 9, and they that were hired about the 11th hour, they received every man a penny. Verse 10, but when the first came, they supposed that they should have received more. They likewise received every man a penny. And when they had received it, they murmured against the good men of the house, saying, these last have wrought but 1 hour, and thou hast made them equal unto us, which have borne the burden and heat of the day. And he answered one of them and said, friend, I do thee no wrong. Didst thou not agree with me for a penny? Take that thine is and go thy way. I will give unto this last, even as unto thee. Now look at verse 15. Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with mine own? Is thine eye evil because I am good? In other words, under God's law, could a man do what he wanted with his own money? Yes, he could. He could do what he wanted with his own money. He chose to give those who only worked a little while more money. That's his choice. He hasn't cheated the ones. Did they not agree to work 11 hours in a day or 12 hours in a day for money? Yes, they agreed with that. Did they get that at the end of the day? Yes, they got exactly what they agreed to. So if he chose to give more to others, that's his choice. Mm-hmm. He's not telling you, well, by God's law, I had to divide it all equally and everybody gets the same amount of money. Okay? I think some of you have probably seen the illustration they give about the kids that talk about they wanted socialism in the college class. So the professor began to average the grades and give everybody the same grade. And what happened? Well, grades started going down. The guy that worked all day long to get an A, he didn't like his grade being averaged with a guy that's got a C. They're both of them getting a B, so why should I work that hard? Okay? Next thing you know, nobody's working to get an A, and so the whole average begins to go down. You know what? Socialism doesn't work. Why? Because there is such a thing as what we call the work ethic. Okay? And you know what? It's reward. Randy and I laugh when he first came here, and Randy has the work ethic. Randy does. You want somebody to work? Randy will work. Okay? You get out there to Crown Wine, they want Randy out. He works. Okay? And when he first came to the house, he was raised by a single mother. It's not that he couldn't, he just hadn't been used to that. All right? So I told him every day he had to go out there and split 30 pieces of wood. Well, I got boys that could do that eating a sandwich with their left hand, you know, do 30 pieces of wood. All right, wouldn't be anything to him. And such. But for Randy, it was an awesome thing. It's summer, and it'd take him hours, and, you know. Does anybody remember when you were first learning the work ethic, you know, how aggrieved you felt and how awful you felt you had to do these things? And, you know, and so finally one day I went out there, and I took 75 pieces of wood and put them out there. Big ones. And I said, Randy, if every one of those is gone and chopped up in there, and I showed him $50 in cash, I said, if it's done by 4 o'clock, that's yours. I mean at 3 o'clock. He had sweat coming out of it pouring his body. He walked into the house. He owned the house, all right? He absolutely, you know, we all know that feeling of having worked and it did everything. You know, it's one of the greatest triumphs you could possibly have is to get something done. And then he said to me a couple days later, he said, well, Pastor, I feel bad. I only did it for money. And I said, what do you think I go to work for? You know, you think I'm going into Radio Shack every day because I just love my boss and love trying to convince people to buy batteries or something, you know? No, I go in there because they give me money, all right?
Right.
Money is a measurement of your success. It's a measurement of your ability. It's a measure, and God uses it. God uses money all the time to measure things. And again, if you want someone to work hard, get Randy. You're going to have to convince him why he has to do it. He's not a fool, all right? Yeah. It didn't work. Pleased me with his ability to work. So the thing is, again, what I want you to understand, the man said, was it not lawful for me to do what I want? Quickly, go to Matthew 21. Look at verse 33. Hear another parable. There was a certain householder which planted a vineyard and hedged it round about and digged a wine press in it and built a tower and let it out to a husbandman and went into a far country. And when the time of the fruit drew near, he sent his servants to the husbandman that they might receive the fruits of it. And the husbandman took his servants and beat one and killed another and stoned another. Again he sent other servants, more than the first, and they did unto him the likewise. And last of all he sent them his own son, saying, they will reverence my son. But when the husbandmen saw the son, they said among themselves, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him and let us seize on his inheritance. And they caught him and cast him out of the vineyard and slew him. Do you understand that is the principle of communism? You see a man that owns something, you're working for him, decide, we ought to own this. This ought to be ours. We ought to have all this. If you want to get rich and you really don't want to work, go become a petty bureaucrat in a country and turn it socialist. Okay? And just sit there and rake the money off of those people as they slowly drain and dry up and lose all that they have. Okay? The people in Venezuela, the bureaucrats, are wealthy beyond anything you can imagine. And the people are out there digging through garbage to get food. I saw a thing one time talking about the world's wealthiest people, and we think of George Bezos and, you know, Bill Gates and all that. And they said the problem is we could not measure Fidel Castro's wealth, but he probably has more than all of them together. Hmm. Okay? It's just spread all over. It's all the people's goods, everything. We'd be communists and take it all in together. Okay? That's the spirit behind it right there. Okay? He's the man. We'll kill him, and we can have it all ourselves. Keep this in mind. Your money is your own. You're not required to give one dime to this church. If you're a citizen of the United States of America, you do have taxes you have to pay. If you don't like the amount, get involved in politics. Move to a different state. Do something of that sort, all right? But you have things to pay. But as far as what goes to the church, that's between you and God, okay? I have seen people who have greatly improved their stock by learning to tithe. I've heard the stories, okay? I mean, some of them in the last year or two, tell me the stories, how much their stock has improved. Doesn't make much sense if you can't get by at 100% while you're getting by so well at 90%. But they'll tell you the stories, okay? They'll tell you what it's like. I mean, Ronnie brags about how deep in debt they were to all the power and utility companies and everything. Just almost unhoped, just paying minimum amounts to keep the lights on. They began to tithe and it's all paid off. Man. All of it. It's Man. Gone. Done, okay? And, you know, I've got some others that have told me stories like that and what God's done for them. But I never want you to think that just because you come here, you have to divide your money with us. That's not what God does. That's your money. And one day you're going to face God, and you and him can discuss why you handled your money like you did, okay? But it's yours. Pastor, why don't you close this?